Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today we'll have a look at the recipe for success of Spark Capital. Spark Capital is an investment firm, and portfolio companies include Twitter, Slack, Affirm, Discord, Deal, many, many, many more. And I could have picked some other great names here, and the list of investments is absolutely incredible. I figured out right before this recording that it's also the first interview of our podcast that my guest is doing. I'm very, very grateful for that, because today's guest is Alex Finkelstein, one of the general partners at Spark. You were the first institutional investor in and board member at companies like Flywire, Talkspace, Wafer, all our IPO'd companies by now. And I'm super happy to talk to you about your style of investing, because I think it's interesting to understand what you do differently, to understand your sometimes like more focused on Europe too. So you have a good intersection between the US and Europe, which I think is interesting because I'm German. And there are so many more questions that I have. So Alex, thank you so much for joining, and welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Happy to be here.
Let's dive right in. You've been investing for decades now, and you've seen the rise of the venture ecosystem throughout the years, and especially the last hype cycle too. And there are so many new people who came into the whole ecosystem, and myself included. I'm doing a podcast for 7 years now, but most of what I've seen is a hype cycle, besides maybe the last 1.5 to 2 years. What would you like to say to people like me who have not seen how the startup ecosystem grew over the years, but just have seen the more of the hype time throughout the last years? What should I know about the ecosystem from your perspective?
I think people should realize it's really hard. So if I think of many of the winners that I've been fortunate to be part of, right now, some of those are public companies worth billions and billions of dollars. But if I look back, it's really, really hard. I think of companies where having 3 weeks of cash left and having to lay off a third of the company to buy yourselves a few more weeks to hopefully get to the other side of a really tricky situation. I remember a CEO walking into the second board meeting ever of a company and saying, "Hey, you guys are going to have a lot of questions for me. I don't have any of the answers. Nothing's going according to as I thought it was." So I think 2 years ago, everything seemed easy. But the truth is, even the ones that become huge winners, there's huge ups and downs. It's really, really hard. That's what makes it great and rewarding. If I think of some of those companies I'm talking about, some of those founders and CEOs are some of my closest friends, because we've been through the battles together. It's really, really, it's really tricky. It's really hard, but it's also incredibly rewarding, not just from a money standpoint. I never think of it from those terms, but really through the journey you go on with these people. You become very close with them. It doesn't mean you always agree with them. There's a great level of debate. I think that's all positive. But I think people just looking to get in should realize there are big ups and downs. It's not easy. It's not simple. But it's incredibly rewarding for many, many aspects. If you look back on something that you backed or started when it was a one or two person student project, and then now is a company that was global, employs thousands of people, and has made a difference in the world. Those things are very rewarding. So, but it's not easy, I'd put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because I have so many people who think about starting ventures or going into VC and think like, yeah, look, everything went up throughout the last year, so it can't be that hard. At the same time, I have one big question in mind, and that's I think true for founders and maybe for investors. I think you're better to judge that than I am, but to what degree is naivete helpful for founders in the beginning, to not see what's coming and how hard it might be? And to what degree is it helpful that by now there's so much content about the startup ecosystem and how to build ventures and what it actually takes to build companies, so that you get an understanding of, hey, do you really want to build such a venture? And it will be hard. To what degree do founders need naivete, and to what degree is it good to know how hard it is?
Yeah, I think it's. I think it is good to be a little naive. I think about myself when I was doing entrepreneurial stuff in my early to mid 20s. I had no background in the area I was in. Worked incredibly hard. Lived on couches for 2 years. And I look back at and looking back at that, everyone thought I was crazy. I had no background in that. I look back on that, and it was the best thing I ever did in my career from any aspects. But being naive, I think, was very, very helpful. Not just because it's so hard, but because you really don't know the answer, because often you're creating something that's never been created before. And I think when you're doing that, being naive is not just blindly naive, but when you're kind of going after opportunities that have never been created before, I think it's good to be a little naive, because if you thought you had all the answers, I don't think you'd succeed. So I think having some of that is a good thing.
Your website states, "We have our own style, products can make markets, pattern matching is for non-believers, pitch decks aren't everything, there is no single right way to do this, but there are some pretty wrong ones." And I would love to understand a bit what that means. It's not about pitching Spark to founders, it's about understanding how you think about investing, because I think a lot of founders just look at, okay, who has done what deals, and could that be the investment firm for us? Instead of also looking how do investors think and what makes them tick? And there are so many things that you might not align with other investors that I would love to discuss a bit. And can you describe your approach to investing if you have a founder sitting in front of you and asking, "Hey, Alex, how do you invest? What's important to you? What do you say?"
Yeah, I mean, we're really looking for that product-obsessed founder who's not always but often never done it before, where that product is inside of them. If they don't build that product, start that company, their life just – it's literally inside of them, and their life will not be complete. And they will go to the ends of the world to make that successful. We back a lot of people. I think of some of the companies I backed. They weren't actually companies at the time. They were projects that people were just building because they had to build it. It was literally inside of them, and they couldn't sleep and they couldn't eat unless they were building that. And I gave them a term sheet, and then sometimes even after giving them a term sheet, realized, wow, this actually isn't even a company yet legally. It's just a product that they're building. I love that. We love that. I think of some of the last investments we've made. The founding team came in for a full partner meeting, and a PowerPoint never went up on the screen. It was literally really talking about our backgrounds, their backgrounds, why they started the company, getting to know, really digging in deep on a personal level, and then just going deep, deep, deep on product. So obviously the person that's a lead on that deal had spent a lot of time with those founders in that company, but when they came in for a full partner meeting, it was not throw up a PowerPoint and take us through your slides and we'll make a decision. It was really all of them getting to know all of us and vice versa very, very well, of why we started Spark, why they started their company, and then spending the majority of the meeting literally just in their product. We had all used their product before, but just deep in their product, how they're thinking in terms of our product roadmap. And we never, they actually had a PowerPoint. I think we were probably with them for an hour and a half, and they're like, "So are we not putting up our PowerPoint?" And we're like, "No, this is exactly what we wanted." So I think we're really looking for those founders that are just incredibly product driven and user driven. Those are the people that we get very, very attracted to.
On the other hand, I talk to a lot of investors, mostly in the European ecosystem, to be fair, but, that are looking for pattern recognition, serial founders who have done it before, who they can trust, also often look at traction rather than product obsession, because they're like, "Yeah, but we know that at some point it might also be that the product changes," because it's typically not the case that the first MVP will be how it develops further. So why would we obsess that much about product? So it's interesting to hear, because from a lot of stuff that I hear in Europe, it just sounds different. And for you, it might be
super. Yeah, I mean, I think of one of our companies that's really breaking out right now. There's two companies that were somewhat similar. There was one that was further along, more revenue, had a team that did it before, and there was another company that was not as far along, hadn't really raised any real money. That was, we just thought there was very much more of a product-centric team, but the team had never done it before. And we ended up doing the team that had, much smaller revenue, much less traction, but was much more product-focused. And we think the best product wins at the end of the day. And we actually ended up making investment in that company. And that company has overlapped the other company meaningfully, I think, because of the product focus and the end user customer focus, I should add.
How do you think about different approaches of investing? And why did you decide for product focus rather than let's figure out if the CV of this person matches a founder that we had before? Because I think it, or for me, it feels like a lot of others are doing the latter rather than looking for product obsessed founders.
Yeah, I can't say that. I wouldn't say this one's better than the other. I think there's a lot of different VCs as a firm that have different approaches that are very successful. I think of a lot of different personal VCs that have very different backgrounds from a career perspective that are very successful. So I wouldn't say it's just one. It has to be one way or it has to be the other way. I think if I look at the people around the Spark table, a lot of us have backgrounds in building things, product. I think of some of the most recent people that we've brought on within Spark, Fraser Kelton, who is head of product at OpenAI, Nada Sandman, who is in product at Zenefits, and a number of other people. It's a lot of the people that we tend to hire and bring around our table come out of a background that looks somewhat like that. So I think that probably lends itself to why we think like that. But I wouldn't be critical of other firms. I think there's other approaches that work very well. So no, I mean, I don't think there's one way to do this.
Let's move on. I think there are enough interesting topics that we can cover. One of them being, as I'm German, I recently spoke to one of the founders you backed, and it was Tao Tao from Get Your Guide. And he told me, you definitely have to ask Alex how he convinced us to take his term sheet and take the money from Spark rather than other options that we had. So when you see a founder that you actually want to back, how far do you go to convince the founder that it's a good partnership? And how was it in the case of Get Your Guide?
Yeah, I mean, Get Your Guide's an interesting one where I led the A round of Get Your Guide. They flew to Boston. We spent a bunch of time together. I gave them a term sheet. And then the idea was I would fly over to Berlin, meet the rest of the team. I spent a bunch of time with Johannes and Tao in Boston, meet the rest of the team after giving them a term sheet. And then hopefully signing that term sheet. The day I was supposed to fly to Berlin to really finalize everything, they called me and they say, hey, we love you, man, but there's another term sheet that's a much higher valuation. You're not going to get there. And we don't want you to waste the trip, but we're going with the other firm. Just their valuation is much, much, much higher. So we love you. We're going to stay in touch, but it just doesn't make sense. So that was what happened when I hung up the phone. They got to their office in Berlin the next morning. I was in Boston when we had the phone call. They got to their office in Berlin the next day. I was sitting in their offices and they're like, well, what are you doing here? They were very surprised to see me. And I said, have you guys signed that other term sheet? And they had not. And the truth is myself, Johannes and Tao Tao really stayed up for about 48 hours together talking about everything, talking about life, Get Your Guide, what they wanted to build, product. Honestly, getting to know each other deeply on like a personal level in a 48-hour binge of hanging out. And I still remember we were on the roof deck of the bar at Soho House in Berlin, and I pulled out a crumpled term sheet that I sent to them a few days earlier. And I said, are you guys signing this, or are we signing this? And they looked at each other and they said, we're signing this. And that was kind of how the Series A of Get Your Guide actually happened. I still have a picture of them. They still look about the same age, even though it was a number of years ago. But I think just like I would want founders to be relentless and jump on a plane and do whatever it takes, I do that to this day for recruiting, helping close customers. I think it works both ways. And they knew how much I wanted to make that investment. And we really just got to know each other much, much better after spending really almost 48 hours straight together in Berlin. But that was after they were telling me the deals off don't come.
Tao Tao told me that on the one hand, they never regretted it. So that's a good thing. And he also was like, yeah, Alex tried to call us several times. We didn't pick up. But then we picked it up and he was like, did you sign already? No. Okay, I'm in the plane. I see you in 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever the time.
I think my recollection, is I showed up and they didn't even know I was coming, but I think it's a fun story. I won't get into the specifics, but I think of the last deal I did, actually, I literally cold walked into somebody's office. So I didn't even cold call them. I thought it was very, I literally cold walked into their office. And they were not raising money, but that's literally how that relationship started.
Congratulations. And I think what I also would like to talk about is you mentioned from time to time you meet companies and founders that are so exceptional that you would go to the end of the world for them. What are you doing with the rest of your time? Because I think founders, but also generally a lot of people in the ecosystem don't understand what the job of a general partner is and how you're spending your time, and therefore, can we quickly talk about a typical week in your life? Like, how much is talking to founders? How much is talking to potential deals? How much, like, out of founders, how much is potential deals? How much is portfolio companies? And then also, what happens with the rest of the time? I think it's good to get an understanding for what's happening, because it's sometimes hard to look behind the curtain.
Yeah, I mean, I think every day and every week is very different, which I think fits my personality well. But it's a mix of, that's not exact percentages, but there's board meetings. There's a lot of work outside of board meetings. I spend a lot of time with helping companies recruit, helping them close executives that seem like they're not closable. Helping companies get customers, helping companies think through, should they acquire a company, should they not acquire a company. I don't think our job is to be telling CEOs what to do. I think if we're doing that, it's not good for anybody. So my job is to help in any way possible, but not get in the way and not be telling a founder what to do. It's a lot of listening as well, because there's a million decisions they need to make, and helping them think through what are the really three decisions that can really drive things forward, and not telling them what those three decisions should be, but almost listening and often playing back what I'm hearing to them and helping them make those decisions, but really enabling them to make the decisions, not me to make those decisions. So I do a lot of seed and A's. The first 18 months is usually very intense. Often it's a very young team who's never done it before, and you're helping them put all the pieces in place in terms of team, customers, all those things. So I enjoy that chaotic first 12 to 18 months, when there's usually not a lot of believers and people still think maybe it's a crazy idea, and you're one of the first believers in those people and helping them get to those next early stages. I enjoy a lot of that. So it's that. It's looking at new investments. You're meeting with a ton of new companies, a ton of new entrepreneurs all the time. It's also doing thesis level work of what do you think is interesting and why, and doing fundamental research on what do you think is going to happen in the world in the next 3, 5, 10 years, and often very, very specific areas. There's a little bit of firm management. There's spending time with we have investors as well, so it's spending time with our limited partners as well. So it's really all the above. We're structured. A lot of firms, we have a Monday morning or Monday partner meeting, and we usually bring in 2 or 3 companies to present that day. So Monday is usually a very internal day, and most of the rest of the week is probably more external, if you will.
You mentioned that
But
I.
really every day and every week is different, which for me makes it very, very fun.
Fair. You mentioned that you're helping to recruit a lot. That was one of the things that I haven't heard VCs saying before. And not that they don't do it, but that's just something that people often go, I think, do in silence. Let's talk about helping founders recruit the executives that they might not be able to hire otherwise, or that seem like you can't hire them. How do you, because I often talk from the founder perspective with founders about what does it take an executive to be the right one for the company. How do you assess executives, and how do you figure out if they actually are the right fit for your portfolio company and for the founder that you're trying to help?
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to the first part of your question. I mean, I spend a lot of my time recruiting, both introducing people in my network to portfolio companies where they could be a good fit. I mean, the truth is, really great founders are recruiting people that they're getting them in front of me to interview them. And I'm saying, wow, I can't believe this person's even interviewing for this 15, 20 person company. It's amazing you even got them to this stage. But then it's a lot of time when someone does seem very special at closing them. I mean, these could be people that are making $1 million a year, and all of a sudden you're convincing them to make $75,000, $100,000 a year. And that may seem crazy. And I've had cases where I've literally met with the spouse of someone we're trying to close, and just me and the spouse have gone out to dinner, not even the person that we were recruiting, because the person has three kids and a mortgage, and it's crazy. They're going to take this startup job and make almost no money. And the spouse is saying, "Why would you ever do this?" So it's really, I spend a lot of my time closing people that maybe seem like it's unclosable, but seem, if you can bring these few very special people and put them around great founders, it really makes all the difference in the world in these companies. So I spend a lot of time doing that. But what it's tough to say, here's what you're looking for, because it depends on, is it a CTO? Is it a head of sales? Is it a head of product? So they're often different. So it's tough to say exactly, just given all the areas that we're helping recruit with.
I like that. I think that's the interesting part that I hear. Let me start again. The part that I think is interesting is currently I have the feeling that there's a discussion how early, how senior do I hire? Like when I'm 5 to 10 people, how senior do I hire? I often hear VCs telling me, hey, you have to hire as senior as possible. And then at the same time, I talk to founders and they're like, yeah, but on the one hand, sometimes I don't have the budget, or it doesn't feel right to hire these senior people. And like it's an interesting conflict that also is not black and white, so not at all. But how do you think about, because I can imagine you're talking about this with your founders and portfolio companies often, how senior do you hire in early stages? Let's say you're at seed stage, you're investing in seed, and then the founder comes and is like, hey, can what would you do? And often they have their own perspective, but they want to know what you think. How senior would you hire early on? And for what companies
I mean,
does it make sense to hire?
I think it depends on different stages. I mean, I want people that are going to do the work. So sometimes you can hire someone with a fancy resume and they're look great on paper, but they want a CMO title and they're going to hire a bunch of people. I want to hire people that are going to really do the work. I think this is true in our portfolio, and I'm talking to other VCs. It's true in a lot of portfolios. If they're looking at some of their companies where they probably, raised a lot of money, they overhired, they hired a lot of people who had great backgrounds. And given what's gone on in the last, 2 years, their work cut back. So a lot of these people were let go from some of these companies. And I think across the board, from what I'm hearing from founders, is we probably hired people that were too senior for the stage we're at. Now that we're have actually let some of those people go, things are actually happening much quicker, much better. Everyone on the table are the people that are doing the work. And it was probably a mistake to hire those people that maybe had great resumes. But we're probably hiring people that actually do the work as opposed to doing the work. So I think there's definitely some lessons learned there. And a lot of I think it's really across the board. Every conversation I'm having is things are just happening quicker, better, when we actually let people go. I think there's lessons learned for everybody there. And I think there's different stages. I mean, there's a type of person that sometimes gets you to from 0 to 25 million in revenue. And there's someone else that can get you, and some people scale all the way. But sometimes you get to a company where, all right, we need someone we're at $100 million in revenue. How do we get to 250 to 500? And let's bring in a few people that have done that before. But then there's other people in your company that can scale to those next levels, and it's a balance. And there's some people, it's tricky sometimes. There's some people that you wouldn't have gotten to that next level if you didn't have them, but they don't have that next gear to go from 100. They got you from 0 to 100, but they don't have that 100 million to $500 million gear. But you wouldn't have gotten there without them. And sometimes you do have to let those people go, which is heartbreaking. You have to do that incredibly well and incredibly classy. And truth is, sometimes those people, when you talk to them, become good friends with them, they actually want to go back into another startup. But this has gotten too big for me. I want to go back to something earlier, and it's often a relief for them. But those are tricky conversations.
Yeah, that's true. I also have this conversation often with founders where they're like, yeah, I figured out my co-founder, for example, is not scaling. And I have to think about, do I find another role for this person? Because I love the person. We started a company together, but it's one of the difficult conversations that I, as a founder, now have to make. And that is, or can I find a way that we split ways, or that it's a non-operational, non-executive role that the co-founder gets into. So that's not only true for early employees, that's also for co-founders. That sometimes happens that you have to think about, okay, how do I restructure my team? If and also I think a lot of founders assess themselves often, do I scale with the company or not? And if not fast enough, how can I improve my personal development and growing with the company? Or do we have to find somebody at a certain stage to do the CEO work, for example? It's often a discussion that's just happening for reasons, just happening behind the curtains that people are not often talking about, and it's not often discussed, I think.
I think it's actually, I think it probably is discussed more than, does this person still have that next level? I think not founders, but just across the board, whether it's an executive, whether it's a mid-level employee, I think when you feel like you start hesitating, does this person really have that next level? I think, or they're not as great as you thought they were. I think one of the biggest mistakes founders and, boards make as well is, let's see another card, let's see another card. I think when you know, and when you start feeling that, don't hesitate, because you may have a salesperson, a head of sales, and hey, if that person leaves, then we're going to miss our next quarter because they have a lot of the relationships, even though they're not great. You got to feel the pain, let that person go, and hire someone that is truly great, regard just given what stage you're at.
I have one completely different topic that I think I mentioned it quickly in the beginning, that I realized that you haven't done a podcast, for example. You never posted on LinkedIn before. You're not writing blog posts all the time. You are mostly spending your time with the companies you're working with, or you want to work with, or limited partners and your own team. In a world where pretty much everybody is trying to produce a lot of content and try to get reach to build brand, how do you think about building brand as an investment firm? Because I think it's, if we look 10 years into the future, 15 years into the future, and we assume that you're still doing Spark Capital by then. How do you think about building brand for the company and your role in that? Because I think it's just, I was super, super stoked, I would say, that you resist producing a lot of content. Of course, you're focusing on the work that you're doing, but I just want to get an understanding how you think about what it takes to build a great venture firm. And disclaimer, as we talked about the investment strategy, that's one of the ways to build a company. It's not about saying other approaches are bad or this one is the best. It's just understanding how you think about things. So how do you think about building a successful venture firm for the future, and positioning it for the future in a world where pretty much everybody thinks it's about brand and eyeballs and trying to produce as much content as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I guess ironically, I used to write television shows. So I wrote and created and sold television shows for Fox, Discovery, ITV1 in the UK, E. So ironically, I was in venture and then left venture and wrote and sold a number of television shows. So I was actually in the content space for a number of years, which was a lot of fun. I don't think it's something I say I'm not going to do something, but what I really care about at the end of the day is what founders will say about me. Like when I'm competing for a deal or looking at a deal, I don't have a Spark sales pitch that I'm telling someone in a 2-minute soundbite. If I'm really interested in something, talk to the founders that I've been in the trenches with since the earliest days when I was the first believer. Hearing those, that's really what I care. So I feel like my brand may what I my all I really care about is what are those founders and CEOs and executives who I've been in the trenches with think and say about me on a business level, on a personal level. That may not be you have a megaphone and you're telling that brand to everybody in the world, but I feel like if I'm serious about a company and the founder that I'm that company I'm looking at speaks to all the founders that I work with, that's really all I care about at the end of the day. And I don't care about telling the whole world about that. I care about when that founder that I'm looking at speaks to 10, 15, 20 CEOs I've worked with in my career, maybe more. That's really what I care about. And what was Alex really like in all of these situations? What was Spark like in all these situations? That is really all I care about at the end of the day.
I really like that approach. The only thing that I would love to ask is, don't you think you, like, from what we talked about, and we only have by now 38 minutes of talking, therefore we will never have enough time to cover all the topics possible. But I can imagine the founders learned a lot just by listening to this episode, and I can imagine that founders could learn so much more if you by from time to time would do another podcast or write a short post about observations on LinkedIn or Twitter or wherever. And I can imagine that so many founders could learn from you and from your experiences that I think would be amazing for them to have the chance to, even I know it's effort. At the same time, I
Yeah, it's
also
not effort.
think.
I mean, the truth is, I get reached out by the press all the time, and I'd rather the founders and the CEOs take that press. So sometimes the press reaches out to me all the time, and I honestly turn it back to the press. We could give you a great quote for that. Would be the founder of XYZ, CEO of XYZ company. Why don't I introduce you to him or her? Because I'd rather them take the press. To me, that's like they're the one that started that company. They're the one that took all that risk. So I do get calls by the press all the time, but I often turn it back towards them talking with one of my CEOs or founders because I'd rather them get the press on and say than me. I'm fine with that. So I'm not
I
like
love that.
anti-press. I'm not anti-press. I think the founder could give a better quote sometimes than me because they're the one that took the risk. They're the one that started this company when everyone said it was terrible. So as opposed to me talking about this company and taking a lot of credit, I'd rather them talk to the founder and the CEO of that company. So I often do get calls from the press about stuff like that all the time, but I often almost always push it back and route that to one of the CEOs.
At the same time, you're in a position where you're working with so many different founders that you have observations over many companies. So let's say you have 10 companies who had the same issues and you saw how founders handled them differently or how these issues showed up in a different form and character. And it could be interesting to sometimes write 10 things you should know about hiring a VP of VP architect, just as a as an example. And it would be so interesting for a lot of founders to read that because it would help them a lot. And I think that's something that you could do better than one founder who had one of the perspectives. And that's just what I'm thinking about, like how
I think it's a good point.
rich the ecosystem could be when you would share sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes a perspective where you're like, hey, that would be an interesting or important problem to talk about.
I think that's fair.
Not convincing you to do that stuff. It's more that
No, yeah, no,
I just
I'm not saying no, I'm just I hear you.
just one of the topics that I like your perspective. And in a world where everybody's making a story out of anything, that's super good to hear your perspective and see that it's that people are also focused on building and doing stuff. Just sometimes exactly those people focused on building and giving others the attention. It would be so interesting to hear and listen more or read and learn from these people. So therefore that was just my short in the end nudge
I
to
will work
say,
on it.
hey, maybe you can also ask some, I saw your team does a podcast. Maybe sometimes once in a quarter or once half a year they should invite you for a specific topic that you realize that you want to talk about, and then maybe some founders can learn from that. Alex, I think we covered a lot of topics, even when I have way more questions, to be honest. But I really enjoyed your perspective on investing. I think hiring executives is an important topic. I love the story about Get Your Guide. I really appreciate your humbleness and how you try to push everything that includes press on everything to your founders, even when I would wish to read from you from time to time, something on any or listen to something from time to time, because I think it will be super helpful. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for joining. I'm very grateful that you took the time, especially now knowing that you typically don't do that. So thanks for everything, and super happy to hand over the last words of the show to you, for letting you and letting founders know something that you want to give them on the way for the last words.
No, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. I would just say persistence wins and never give up. And I wish everybody luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex.
Bye-bye.